Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to thank the 10 to 20 million people out there who are now watching our show because they want something different, something that's not just a corporate message. We try and bring you the truth here, which is why on this day, I thought it would be important to catch you up on what's happened. It's been really a whirlwind over the last 24 hours. Everything has changed when it comes to this war between the United States, Israel, and Iran. Remember, I said, and I mentioned to you that the ceasefire yesterday was not much of a ceasefire. Well, now I can say without a shadow of a doubt that there is no ceasefire and it's game on. Essentially, the war is back on. What I want to do now is I want to show you the map of the region, and we're going to go step by step so I can explain to you how we've gotten into this position. And it starts essentially with the President of the United States offering something that is called Project Freedom. That's what it's called, Project Freedom. Project Freedom for the President of the United States is essentially an effort where you see these little arrows that go around and create this loop here. He's basically using U.S. naval vessels, mostly frigates and some destroyers, to go into this area, escorting some of the ships that they hope can get back into the Strait of Hormuz and back out of the Strait of Hormuz, right? And that's what this represents. And what we understand from the United States is that they were able to escort at least two ships. More on that in a moment. First thing I want to do is let you see how this was reported yesterday, because it was a big deal. It was reported in the United States. Here it is.
This morning, with the war in Iran now in its 10th week and the economic toll of the conflict mounting here at home, President Trump announcing the U.S. will help stranded cargo ships leave the Strait of Hormuz starting today, dubbing it Project Freedom. The president posting we will guide their ships safely out of these restricted waterways so that they can freely and ably get on with their business.
I want to tell you now about those two merchant vessels, because that's what they're called. You know, I looked it up. When I saw the report that the United States had somewhat been braggadocious about the fact that they had been able to escort two vessels in and out of the Strait of Hormuz, the first thing I thought was, well, what kind of vessels are they? Were they tankers, for example? Were they something that carries either oil or LNG or potassium or something that's used for fertilizer? That would be a big deal. And how big and what type of ships were they? Well, as it turns out, when I did a little research on this, I found out they were merchant vessels. And merchant vessels essentially means that they're still significant that they were able to get them in and out of there. But the ships in and of themselves, in terms of what they carry, is not significant. These are ships that essentially carry supplies, cars, equipment, that type of thing. Now, the question is, what has been the reaction from the Iranians? And that, in and of itself, has been very significant. The Iranians have been using missiles and drones to fire down into this area. You see, and by the way, let me show you something on the map, which I think is really important at this point. You see these two yellow lines we've put there? What we wanted to do was show you the expansion of the new Strait of Hormuz area as it's now being contained by the Iranians. For them, this is pivotal, right? This is their ace in the hole. They have control of the Persian Gulf. And now because of what they say are the United States actions, they've actually expanded the control of the Persian Gulf. And there's also a tactical reason why they did this. I want to show you something now. See that city there, Fujairah? That's where one of the main oil fields is for the UAE. Now, you see that black line that's going from there all the way to there? See that black line? That is an oil pipeline. And that pipeline essentially is the UAE's way of getting oil out without having to worry about traveling through the Strait of Hormuz, because the exit for that pipeline was outside of the Strait of Hormuz. So what the Iranians have now done is they've expanded the Strait of Hormuz area that they are in control of to go beyond the point where Fujairah is. And that's extremely significant because it means now that they control even more of the output of the hydrocarbons, the oil, the LNG, the fertilizer, all the stuff that's coming out of this region, and most particularly the most important region of all, which is the UAE. So that's what they're doing. On top of that, by the way, they're using drones and missiles immediately. When they heard Mr. Trump announce what he was doing with, what is it again, Project Freedom, They decided they were going to do what they had threatened to do all along, and that is use their missiles to take out whatever's there that's trying to enforce this for the United States. Here's a report. This report, interestingly enough, is from Australia, talking about two ships that were hit yesterday by the Iranians. Here it is.
Reports that a South Korean tanker and a UAE-flagged oil tanker have also both been hit while just sitting at anchor in the Gulf. The strikes on the South Korean ship, on the UAE tanker, and the missile strikes against the UAE suggest the Iranians are still trying to avoid direct confrontation with the Americans.
So all of this stuff that I'm describing to you has happened over the past 24 hours, and it's almost like a series of events that have taken place, which is why we thought it would be critical for us to be able to explain this by using the map, so it gives you a reference point of where these things are happening. The other thing the Iranians immediately did is they deployed their midget brigade, their fast boats that they have running all throughout this area. Some people estimate they have about 1,000 of those small boats that get in and out of the ships and can sometimes be used against these ships. In fact, we've got some archival footage. Let me show you what they look like. I mean, they almost look, and by the way, this is Iran kind of showing them off and showing what they can do, and that they're able to put some rocket launchers on them, which you're about to see right here. See right there how they use these things, and they can patrol the Gulf that way? Well, they have a bevy of those all over the Gulf, and they apparently were sent off from all those different ports around Iran yesterday. The United States, interestingly enough, has come out and said that they have apparently destroyed seven of those launchers, PT boats, kind of what they look like, or smaller, actually, in that area that they've been able to get rid of up to now. There's something else I want to show you, because it bears repeating how the Iranians at this point have a huge territorial advantage. And it's geographic. That's all it is, really. If you look at this area right there, now you see all that, it looks like a mountain range up there, right? So they're sitting on a perch, which is really difficult for any enemy of theirs, in this case, what they call the United States Navy, to go in there and not be in a vulnerable position. In fact, I've got a picture of it. Look at these mountains, just so you can see it from a reference point. There's the ships, there's the mountains. Now look at that. See those cliffs? Over the last couple of years, the Iranians have, according to our sources, put silos inside of those mountains from whence the rockets and some of the drones fly out of. And as soon as they fly out of the mountain, it kind of closes up again, so it's almost impossible for the United States or for anybody else to go in there and take those out. So it really has given them, up to now, a huge strategic advantage. Let me tell you about something else that happened yesterday. This is also is important. See that area right there? It's called Jask. In the reports, it's being called Jask Island, but it's not really an island. It's really more of like a little peninsula. That's one of the most important ports. You see, it's outside, but it's not far from the Strait of Hormuz. And that's a very important place because the United States has been trying to go in there and possibly take it. Well, yesterday, there was a report that the Iranians had fired at a U.S. frigate and hit it, or maybe even destroyed it, in that area. Turns out that's not true, at least the part about destroying it or even hitting it. What likely is true is that the Iranians are now firing from that mountain range where I told you, using drones, using rockets, using missiles, and trying to hit whatever they can in this area, including that. And there's this Reuters report that I think kind of characterizes this maybe the best way. Because a lot of people are saying the Iranians didn't do anything. Others are saying, well, no, the Iranians sunk the ship. This is probably the best perspective. Iran is using their geographic advantage to prevent U.S. warships from entering the Strait of Hormuz. And that's what we think actually took place yesterday in Jask Island, or Jask Port, or Jask Peninsula, that kind of changed the game a little bit. And then, of course, you know, if we're wondering whether this thing is back to being a real war, it is. And the proof came last night when the Iranians started firing missiles into UAE. As a matter of fact, they fired at least one right here in the area of Dubai That one was apparently intercepted by the missile defense system that they use here. But another one was not. This is important. Remember I told you earlier about Fujairah? That's that oil field that's right there? That's a very important oil field. Apparently, let me look at my notes, 100 million barrels is kept there. And apparently the Iranians hit it, and it really begs the question then, right? Because we were told all along that something like this couldn't happen because the missile defense system that the United States has installed in the UAE would prevent it from happening. And we understood at the beginning of the war when Iran was just peppering this region right here with lots and lots of missiles and drones that some of them would get through. But last night, as far as we can tell, the Iranians only shot three or four, and one of them got through and hit the very place they really wanted to hit. So what does that tell us? I guess maybe the question is, what should we be asking about the missile defense system, the THAAD missile defense system, Patriot missile defense system, and why it isn't, working as well as promised, so to speak. Now, so what's the result of all of this? First of all, the war looks to be back on, all right, obviously, because both sides are now firing or threatening to fire. But the second thing which is really important is the economic impact this is going to have on the world. I mean countries all over the world now who are starting to get an inkling of flow, right? Outflow. That's a little bit more of the potassium, of the fertilizer, of the LNG, of the oil that was getting out into the world that is so needed, was starting to get out. Now, it's dead. Let me show you a picture. I've got another map that we found that we want to show you. There's there are actually websites that tell you where the ships actually are at any given time. And this is what the Strait of Hormuz looks like right now. Look at that. You don't see any red dots, which means there are no ships there. That means there's no inflow. There's no outflow. There's no ships traveling in and out of this area. Look at this. Look at this area. I mean, remember that area we had from here all the way to there? I mean, there's nothing getting in, and there's nothing getting out. And that means this thing is blocked up again, or all over again, as we say. And it looks like the war is also back on. All those things happen just within the past 24 hours when we come back. Let's talk about the effect this is having in other parts of the world, particularly the politics of Europe. Germany is one of the places we're looking at this time, just to see how the people there are reacting to the fact that they're not getting the energy that they've always wanted, but that they used to have in the past, and they're asking serious questions of their leadership. That's when we come back. Stay right there. Welcome back to The Sanchez Effect. Have you noticed that there's a sense that people, especially in the West, are kind of getting fed up with decisions that are being made by their leaders that don't in any way benefit them, right? It's got different names. People call it different things at different places. Some call it the Epstein class, right? Some call it the elites. Some call them oligarchs. Others call them the billionaire class or the donor class, who buy politicians, and in some cases, hell, they buy entire governments. We've seen it. I see this trend playing out in the United States of America. I hear from my friends there all the time who tell it to me, and that people there are realizing it for the first time in a long time and trying to hold their government officials accountable for it. It's also playing out in Europe. And if there's one place in Europe where it's been very prevalent of late, it's in Germany. There, the chancellor actually has a nickname. A nickname that it kind of tells you everything you need to know about how the people of Germany feel about him, right? And the nickname is BlackRock Merz. BlackRock Merz. Why? Because that's who they think he really answers to. That's who he used to work for. And that's who he is beholden to. An investment company that, by the way, is the biggest investment company in the world and far bigger than most countries, including Germany. That's right. The company he worked for is bigger than the company he now serves, or the country he now serves. I'm not sure he knows the difference. So why am I saying this? Because I've seen a trend. This weekend, for example, the people of Germany, they let him have it. They let Merz have it. Look at these rallies. huge, right? This is the big May 1st parade they have every year, but this time it was just nuts. Got out of control, too, with police. Bigger than ever, most would argue. And they're angry. And there's all types of people represented here. In this particular event, it was mostly workers, socialists, some libertarians. And there you could see where the scuffle started with police, because they're angry and their signs tell the story. They're opposed to the BlackRock-funded wars. They're opposed to the oligarchs in their government telling them what to do. They're opposed, most of all, to their leader, Frederick Merz. Yes, that Frederick Merz, the one who brags about being a multimillionaire. He actually has. The one who brags about owning not one, but two private jets. Yes, he's actually done that. Can you imagine how you would feel if that was the guy leading you and he was telling you how rich he is while you're having a hard time just putting enough euros together to keep your home warm in winter? So, yeah, there's a change feeling in the air in Germany these days. It's not just coming exclusively from the left or from the anti-capitalist crowd, by the way, as in the past. In fact, the biggest critics in Germany right now belong to this party called the AfD. At least that's how we say it in American English. This is the country's, like, conservative party. Some would say ultra-conservative party. It's actually now all overtaken all of the other parties in the country. So why have they, this AfD, why has it become so popular? What is it that they're saying? Well, they want their government to stop supporting fake and endless wars, like the ones in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Iran, et cetera, et cetera. Also to stop sending hundreds of billions of dollars of their hard-earned euros overseas to some of these countries. Makes sense, right? And they also want to reestablish relations with Russia, this party does, so they can cut their energy costs in half by getting it from a country next door rather than having to pay through the nose for oil and gas that's coming from halfway around the world, right? Totally get that. Who doesn't? There's one thing they also want. They want to stop taking all these refugees who are coming into their country from all of these wars that their government supports. Immigrants, they say, who are essentially changing the culture of Germany. So that's the AfD, one of the parties. And you saw some of the leftists and socialists and labor parties out there on the street. So there's a lot of anger right now. By the way, these are the polls. This is what the polls look like right now in Germany between, I mentioned how well the AfD is doing. It was at 25, then 26, 27. Now look, it's at 28, it's rising. They lead all parties, and then most of all, they lead Merz's party. Merz's party is the CDU, as you can see right there. They're at 24. And if this thing keeps going, they may knock Mr. BlackRock out of office. So we wanted to know. I am fascinated by Germany. It's an important country. It's a wonderful country with wonderful, wonderful people. And but it's going through a crisis right now. Is this change real? And what's it going to lead to, if anything? Joining us now is somebody who can help us answer some of these questions. Sabine Dagdelen is a prominent German politician. She's a foreign policy expert. She served in the Bundestag and is currently the spokesperson for the BSW party. Sabine, thank you so much for joining us. So nice.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me. Nice to meet you.
So let me just ask you straight out. Are the people of Germany angry? Do they want change?
Well, what is fact is that they do not want this current government under Chancellor Friedrich Merz, because he is as much popular as, for example, athletes' food. He's very unpopular, and the most of the people of Germany are not satisfied by this government run by Friedrich Merz.
What is the most important thing, or what would you say they hate the most about him?
Well, I do believe that Chancellor Merz is, in any case, a chancellor who broke his promises before the elections. he said no new debts. And the first thing he started after the national elections last year was new debt and changing the constitution for that. Secondly, he is totally off regarding social healthcare, social houses, and for the needs and the problems of the majority of the people in Germany. And we could have seen this last weekend when he was a guest in a show and he was asked, for example, what did he achieve in 1 year of governing Germany? And he had a long, long pause before he started that he rescued the NATO, the biggest military pact in the world, for example. Or he didn't know what kind of expenses the health security is for a normal normal worker. So he's very much far away from the normal all-day problems of the people. And well, as I said, he broke his he has broken all these promises he has done, and he is governing and doing a policy no one voted for. Social cuts, financing the proxy war in Ukraine. Germany is now in the front row in sending weapons, sending money, doing this Ukraine-German strategic partnership in, for example, establishing a German-Ukrainian military industrial complex and so on, but nothing for the people here in Germany.
Why would it surprise you that a guy who is a banker, the first thing that came out of your mouth when I asked you about him is that he said he wouldn't get us into debt, and he did. He is all in favor of loans. Of course he is. How do you think bankers make money? Loans. So what does he do? He gets more debt, borrows more money, sends that money to countries like Ukraine rather than using it for the people of Germany. Sounds to me like exactly what you get if you put a banker in as the president of the United States. I mean, the chancellor of Germany.
I mean, you're totally right. The problem is, I would say he's actually now taking the politics of Angela Merkel, for example, and even Olaf Scholz to the extreme. For example, he is doing the loans for a rearmament of Germany. His goal is to establish, I think it's very much a coincidence, that 100 years after 1939, the new military doctrine of the German government under Friedrich Merz is having a goal. It said that Germany has to have the biggest, the strongest military in Europe by 2039.
Wow.
But the rearmament of the German army already began under Angela Merkel in 2014. And it has been accompanied by the neglecting of infrastructure and an attack to the welfare state in Germany under Merkel, and then further on with Olaf Scholz. And Merz is now taking this to the extreme.
But why? But why? Why does Germany need to have the biggest army in the world all of a sudden? What? Where's the threat? I don't see it. But explain it to me. Or what does he say? Wait, don't tell me. Russia's about to invade Germany. Wait. I think I got it. Russia is about to invade Germany, and it's going to happen tomorrow morning, right? Just like Iran has nuclear weapons, and they're going to have them tomorrow morning as well, right? Sound familiar?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is the narrative by the German government. So the military doctrine states that Germany is to become the strongest army again, because of the threat coming from the East again, like it was in the past, you know? And that's why I said, leaving aside the certainly unintentional magic of the numbers.
You're German. Do you think Russia's about to invade Germany? And please explain to me why or what the evidence is.
No, I think there is no threat by Russia. I think Russia is not interested in German territory because Russia has enough territory. Russia is not interested in the decline of the German industry. And we do not have so many resources, raw materials, for example. We don't have them. So I do not think that there is an attractive model to attack Germany or other NATO state, because taking aside all the possible thinkings and scenarios, one thing is very clear, that I do believe that the Russian government is deciding very rational. Rational means attacking a NATO member state means to have war with the NATO, the biggest military pact in on Earth. Mm-hmm. And that means that would be an apocalypse, an Armageddon for both sides, for Russia and the NATO states. So I think whoever is sane and has a rational thinking is thinking that Russia and the United States and NATO are not interested to have war. But although, nevertheless, we are facing a real big, massive rearmament of the NATO and Germany. I mean, Germany.
Yeah, but let me just stop you there, because I want our viewers to understand what is really happening here, right? Yeah. So we have a situation, and we can go through all of these things, but we have a situation where Germany could have a decent relationship with Russia. You don't have to love Russia. You could hate Russia, whatever. But you know what? Business is business. And if I can sell you an apple for half the price that you pay for it from somebody else, even if you don't like how I smell, you're still going to buy the apple from me, because it makes sense, unless you're an idiot, right? You know, I want to pay double for everything. Okay, fine. Well, you're going to go bankrupt. So here's Germany in a situation where they can have relations with Russia and get their oil for like half the price. Russia has more resources than just about any country in the world, and they're practically neighbors of Germany, and they could make this decision to do that. But they choose instead that they want to get their oil from far away and all their other resources from far away and make the people of Germany pay more for it. Why would you do that? Unless you're just a banker or a lawyer who's trying to make money from these deals. Is that the case?
Well, as you can see, we don't face only bankers as head of states in Europe. The problem is the majority of the European states are vassals to the United States. Mm. And in this vassalage, they are doing what the United States want from them. For example, now, I'll just give you one example. The so-called beef between Friedrich Merz and Donald Trump. Yeah. It's just theater. It's just theater. So the 5,000 troops Donald Trump is now withdrawing from German territory, they have approximately 40,000 U.S. troops on German territory, on German soil, and they are now doing the withdrawal of 5,000. And then they have the deployment of U.S. missiles, what they did plan for this year, the stationing of U.S. missiles targeting Russia on German soil. They put it now on hold by the time being now. And why do they do this? Because they have a strategic thinking. The U.S. wants to concentrate their own resources against their main enemy called China. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they need the resources challenging Russia from Europe, especially from Germany. That's the thing. Germany and Europe, they put in the front row against Russia, like it was ever before. I mean, I met personally Brzezinski and the Eurasian Chest Board and all these theories that you have to put to split Germany and Russia and put some tensions because to profit from these relationships as United States. It's the same ideology since then, and it's still going on, and this is the theater. So they are pulling out 5,000 troops, but they are still, Germany is still member of the NATO, and as a member state of the NATO, as a military pact run by the United States, as an instrument of their hegemonic approach to the world, they are all vessels. And since you are a vassal state, you also have to be a vassal in economic and social politics. Yeah. That's why we are cutting ourselves from the cheap energy from Russia and now getting the dirty and more expensive LNG gas from the United States, which is not compatible with the needs of the German industry like it was in the past, for example.
We need
time for the transformation as well. And now we are having a decline. And who is benefiting from the decline of Germany and the European industry? It's the United States.
Of course.
And why the United States has to put their so-called allies, which are in truth vassals, in the decline because of their own decline. They are facing their own decline because of the multipolar world of the Chinese and the BRICS states. And they have to stop, or, for example, they have to just lower down their speed to their own decline. And that's the thing what they're doing. You're facing two imperial powers. The one is United States. They are losing their hegemony in the world. And that's why they have to give their own vassals as a victim.
Yeah, no. There's no question that most Europeans have turned into vassal states for the United States. But the United States doesn't give a crap about its citizens and doesn't make decisions to benefit its citizens. There is nothing for the people of America in this war in Iran, for example. There was nothing for the people in America about the war in Iraq, or the war in Vietnam, for that matter, or the war in Syria or Libya. These are wars that are being fought for purposes other than the needs of the people of the United States. And they feed it down, as you so well and eloquently just explained, to the countries in Europe who do the same damn thing to their people. We see it all the time. That's why. I mean, look at the May Day. Look at the parades in Germany this weekend. We got the videos of it, and you could just see it in the people that they're trying to tell their governments, enough of this. You know, we want to see some kind of change. The question for you about as we watch this video is, you know, you have so many different parties. You have to have enough of them come together and maybe even join the AFD, whoever's on top, to form a coalition to take down Mr. BlackRock. Otherwise, even if he loses the election or his party loses the election, he's going to remain chancellor and nothing's going to change, right?
Yeah, but the problem is, you know, in your introduction, you were talking about the AFD. And let me just be clear, the AFD is a pro-NATO party. As a pro-NATO party, I think it's a contradiction to say we want a friendship with Russia, because the NATO is against Russia. So, they voted in the parliament. I mean, I was there, I was witnessing this, in favor of the enlargement of the NATO. The NATO enlargement is one of the main reasons of the Ukraine war.
Well, let me ask you this. Hold on. I'm going to stop you because you got to make a decision. If tomorrow I asked you, you got to choose one. You either choose Mr. Mertz's party or you choose the AFD. Are you going to stay with Mertz? Because that's what you're going to get.
No, I think the question is not right, because we have to choose peace-loving people, freedom-loving people, and freedom-loving and peace-loving policy. This is what the people are want. I mean, you showed all the videos and the footage of 1st of May, and we do have ten thousands of young people who are protesting against military draft, for example. They are planning in Germany and to introduce it again, like in the past. And these people, they do not want to, you know, do not want to choose between a pro-NATO Friedrich Merz and a pro-NATO AfD, which are both on the same side, pro-rearmament and pro, for example, military draft. Mm-hmm. So that is the problem we are facing. The problem is, why became the AfD so popular, as you have shown? They became popular because no one from the establishment party wants to work with them. And everyone who is angry with the establishment party, with the mainstream parties, choosing them as an oppositional party. But the thing is, they do want to be in a coalition with Friedrich Merz. That's the truth. Mm. They do want to. They are, they desiring to be part of the coalition of Friedrich Merz. And that is the problem. So as long as we do have this pro-rearmament, pro-NATO policies, we do not really change.
Don't they have two positions that you or most Germans would find attractive? One is they're against the unnecessary war. They have spoken out against the war in Ukraine and the funding for it. And they are also for creating relations with Russia so that they can get efficient and less expensive oil. Aren't those things?
Absolutely. We are supporting this. I mean, as BSW, the Zara Wagenknecht Alliance, we always said we are against weaponizing Ukraine. We are against NATO enlargement. We are against this dumb, silly sanctions who are harming us, our industry, our people in Germany, and not any oligarchs somewhere else.
Yeah.
And we want Nord Stream. We want to reintroduce Nord Stream to get cheap energy again from Russia to the people of Germany and to the German industry, because this is what we are facing at the moment. We have a decline, and if you want to stop this decline, you have to have cheap energy. And this is one key thing for the future of Germany. And we want peace with Russia. And that's why we are against NATO, because anybody who wants peace with Russia and a good friendship and a good relation, they have to be against NATO. And by the fact, I mean, I think 80 years after Second World War and after the Warsaw Pact, it's damn time to dissolve the NATO. We don't need the NATO. We need peace.
Isn't NATO aggressive? Isn't NATO an aggressive organization? I mean, NATO attacked Belgrade. NATO's supposed to be defensive, but they attacked Belgrade, they attacked Iraq, they attacked Afghanistan, they've attacked... I mean, when I look at NATO, I'm looking at an organization that's supposed to be for peace and defense, but their record says something different. Am I wrong? And why don't the people of Germany see that?
Well, just in one thing, I would disagree with you.
Okay.
Because you said it's supposed to be a defensive alliance. I say it never has been a defensive alliance. It never was, and there was no interest to have a defensive alliance. The role of the NATO is to secure the interests of the United States.
Hmm.
That's the thing what the NATO is for. That's the thing why it's established by the United States. And it has done war crimes in Afghanistan, in Yugoslavia. The leading country has done war crimes in Iraq, for example. A friend of mine, Julian Assange, he exposed all these war crimes.
Yes.
And the thing is, the NATO is an expensive alliance. It's always busy with expansion. It's very militaristic. It's the biggest military pact in the world. You know, all the money going to NATO, if we would put this money for healthcare, for social housing, for food, for the people, we would overcome starvation in the world, for example. And the other thing is, NATO is for the dominance. And there I'm very thankful for the truthness, for the honesty of the Trump administration, for example. Trump, Secretary of State Rubio, or J.D. Vance, they are very honest in saying that NATO is an instrument for the dominance of the United States. It's not an instrument of defense. It's just an instrument for the interests of the United States. And every member state of the NATO is paying a tribute for this goal, for the interests of the United States. That's why they are paying much more money than needed to the NATO, to the rearmament, and for all these military interventions in the world. And I think it's very, very time to get over the NATO.
Let me show you something. I want to show you the assets of your chancellor, or pardon me, I want to show you the assets of the company that your chancellor used to work for. Some would argue he still works for them. This is BlackRock. I'm going to compare their assets. I've got the numbers up. Their assets to the GDP of Germany. So here we go. BlackRock's assets, $14 trillion. Germany's more or less $4.5 trillion. So if you were Mr. Merz and you really kind of work for both, which one do you think you would be more beholden to?
Well, I mean, the figures are very clear. And it shows also what's wrong in Germany. I mean, we talked about Ukraine very shortly. The most profits of the Ukraine war are going to the US military industrial complex and also the German industrial complex.
And to BlackRock. Wait. You forgot one. BlackRock signed the biggest deal to make
money.
Yeah.
I know, Rick. You asked me why the German government is making politics against the interests of their own people, but in the favor of the interests of the United States. And I tell you one thing.
Yeah.
We do have a compradore bourgeoisie in Germany. That's a bourgeoisie which is making politics in the interests of the US oligarchs and not their own people. And the German industry, people are talking very in general about German industry, German economy. What is the German economy? The biggest shareholders of German economic institutions, corporations, like the stock exchange, the 40 German stock exchange companies in Germany, the biggest shareholder is BlackRock. BlackRock is the biggest shareholder. So that means German economy is not that much German anymore. It's BlackRock ruled. And this is the economic side. And then we have the media. We have the mainstream media where all the, I mean, I know them all, you know. The chief editors, for example, for foreign policy, security policy, all the chief editors in general, they are part of transatlantic think tanks. They are part there. They are members. They are board members.
Yes,
they're getting their handouts. They're getting their briefings. And they are doing politics, or their writings is in the interest of the United States. And third very important aspect is that we have in German politics, for example, young leaders of the World Economic Forum, young leaders of the German Marshall Fund. This is a U.S. Think tank. So the U.S. think tanks, they have a lot of people in German government, German politics in the parliaments, and they are members in this transatlantic institutes. And being a member of the transatlantic institutes is like, you know, you are just one-sided in your narrative, one-sided in your analyze. Like we have this covering of the mainstream media in Germany regarding Ukraine is very one-sided. You know, they are excluding all the pretext. Why did it start this war? Why was the coup in 2014? And that is the reason why we do have politics running in Germany, which is for the interests of the United States and the U.S. oligarchs, or the military-industrial complex, transatlantic, but not in the interest of the German population.
Let me ask you about Russia. And I'll tell you my own personal story. I've always been taught to hate Russia. Bad people, bullies, bad country, whatever, right? Because I was in the United States. And if you're a member of the media in the United States, hell, if you're just a citizen of the United States, you get that message every day. You get it from Hollywood. If you watch a movie from Hollywood, it's always the Russian's always going to be the bad guy, okay, in every movie. So you
like kind of Iranians.
Yeah, and it kind of becomes ingrained in you, right? And you start, and then you realize, as I have, thank God, you come to a place like Moscow, and you realize, wait a minute, the story's actually the other way around. These are people who fought hard. These are people who defended the world from freedom during World War II. I recently was in fact, I've got some pictures here. I recently was in Belarus, and I went to Minsk, and I went to some of the museums, and some of the things I saw made me understand that it was actually the Nazis who went into Russia and killed, just there in that one city, in Minsk, 2.5 million people. Not soldiers, just innocent people who lived there. They just massacred people. And the Russians eventually fought back. And, you know, that's history, and it gets boring, and I don't want to get too far into that. But I get a sense that the people of Europe, and in particular the Germans, when I was last there, when my son got married, when I talked to them, they just have a natural, emotive disdain for Russia and everything that Russia represents. Why is that? And how do you change that?
Well, I would disagree. I mean, we have, for example, in the east of Germany, I don't believe that those in the West who are preparing a war against Russia and want to continue NATO's proxy war in Ukraine, who are very much the same people who are trying to minimize, for example, the role of the Soviet Union in the Second World War and the liberation of Europe from German fascism, I do not think that they will be successful in the east of Germany because the population, the German population and the east of Germany, even though the falling down of the wall is long away, far away now, but I still can witness and observe that the people want good relation with the eastern neighbors, including Russia.
That's
they
good.
Want peace with Russia. And we do have the same in the West. I mean, the most of the people in Germany, according to polls, they do not want war with Russia. They want peace with Russia because they know that peace without or against Russia on the European continent is not possible. There's only peace with and not against Russia in Europe. And the German governments, I mean, you told you mentioned the past, the German government's decision to exclude Russian representatives from official commemoration events, for example, is it's a part of the attack on memory because they know that the people in Germany are thankful for the liberation of Europe, the liberation of Germany by the Soviet army, the Red Army. We know this. And that's why they are constantly attacking the memory. They want to erase this from the memory because to prepare a war against Russia, it's not helpful to have a picture of the Soviet Union and the Red Army soldiers and the Russians that they liberated Europe and the world from fascism. And that's why I do not believe this, that the majority of the German people are against Russia. I think the elites, and as I told you, the transatlantic elites in media, in politics and so on, yes, the vassals, the comprador bourgeoisie, but not the German worker at Thyssen or at Volkswagen in the car industry and so on. They do not have any anger with the Russian people. Why should they? Although we do have such mainstream propaganda against Russia, of course, we do have this. And that's why I am so much rallying for peace in Ukraine, because we have to stop this war in Ukraine to get along with Russia again. We need peace. And because of this, I think it's very, very important to have a long-standing ceasefire and not just on the 8th and the 9th of May, the ceasefire in Ukraine. We have to stop this war. We have to stop this killing. And so we can have, again, a better relations.
That's great. You know, you are a fabulous person to talk to. And you have... I think awaken many people to ideas that are new because, as you said in our conversation, oftentimes these ideas come from people who are beating them over the head with old ideas and old thoughts. And it's really nice to be able to have this conversation with you. If somebody wants to get a hold of you or reach out to you, is there any way they can do that? Because I know millions of people are going to be watching this. What would you tell them to do?
Well, I think, I mean... Even if the governments are not getting along with each other, I think it's very, very important to know that the normal people are against war, against confrontation, against escalation. They just want to have a normal life, which they can afford. And this is the same with the Germans and the Russians.
And the Americans.
And, I think it's very important to not to have these prejudices and this anger against other people and to oppose the elites' politics, I mean, the governmental politics, and to do anything for friendship, for de-escalation, and for dialogue. That's what I'm doing, for example, on the 10th of May, according to the Day of the Liberation, by the Soviet army, I invited the Russian ambassador for a dialogue. Peace through dialogue. This is my motto.
That's a great model. And I thank you for sharing it with us. And I hope that dialogue and peace can win out over profit, because that seems to be what's driving the war in Ukraine. You have been a very wonderful guest. Thanks so much for joining us, Savine Dagdelen. And let's hope we get a chance to have another conversation in the future. Thank you again.
I'm looking forward. Thank you. Thanks.
So it's time now to share the comments that you share with us after correspondences and sharings and news shows that we share with you. First, you talked about my interview the other day with Charlotte Dubinsky. Also, on the videos that were coming out of Israel depicting attacks on, God, I hate even thinking about this, the videos we showed you of people attacking priests and attacking nuns. And we start with America Hates AIPAC, who says, Zionist-controlled American media spends more time reporting anti-Semitic graffiti, that's so true, often done by Zionists than our enemy Israel committing violence against Christians. I think that's an understatement. Michael, GTW81, says, we only get proper info on the Sanchez effect. Aw, thanks for sharing. Where is the BBC? Where's CNN? Al Jazeera and other so-called human rights defenders? Thank you, Michael. Obviously, I agree, and it's very nice of you to say that. Chris Matthews' other leg says, RT is a Russian-sponsored news outlet. How dare you give them any credibility? Mr. Matthews, you are right. I have a huge bias, if that's what you're talking about. And let me tell you what it is. My bias is not Russian. It's not American. It's not Catholic. It's not Jewish. I do have a horrible bias. My bias is for truth. But you're welcome to call it whatever you want. Have at it, right? Cooters Cruisin says, good show today. And I know I am critical sometimes, but keep it up. Thanks, Cooter. I'll keep him coming as well. And send him as you see him. As for my comment on the fact that we, the United States, have lost wars in Vietnam and Afghanistan and Iraq, and now not looking too good in Iran, Avbiniya says, the U.S. didn't lose any of those wars. It just failed to colonize them completely. Touché. So, as usual, all the feedback is appreciated. You can check out our social media. We're big on X, big on Spotify, big on BitChute. Go to those places, watch what we do, and tell us what we're doing wrong. Meantime, thanks so much for being with us. Thanks for letting us into your homes. And I'll be looking for you next time.